I am Neo. Welcome to the Skeptic Arena. Today is August 10th, 2008. The website is theskepticarena.com. Today we're going to go over argument number 7 from the website of Winston Wu, in which he presents 30 arguments that debunk skepticism. Today's subject, the burden of proof, is on the claimant. Winston begins, "When skeptics who dismiss or deny are challenged to disprove something, they typically respond with this argument, which states that since they are not the ones making the claim, they don't have to disprove anything, but that the burden of proof is on the claimant." Winston, that is completely true. Now you are going to commit the logical fallacy of shifting the burden of proof. Proceed, Winston. Winston proceeds. This argument is similar to the extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. No, Winston, the two are not related at all. In fact, I already agreed with you that extraordinary claims do not require extraordinary evidence. But I completely disagree with you on the issue of burden of proof. They are about as closely related as my rational mind is to your irrational mind. Winston goes on, "While this may sound sensible on the surface, it poses some problems for the skeptic's pursuit of knowledge. First of all, as I said before, just because one is unable to prove something to others doesn't mean that it is false or non-existent. For instance, I can't prove what I dreamed about or thought about yesterday, but that doesn't mean that it didn't happen." Winston, that is true. He continues, "Also, I can't conclusively prove that I saw a certain movie last month either. The skeptics could say that my saved ticket stub was stolen or forged, that my memory of the movie was obtained from hearing about it, that the people that were there with me in the theater only constitute testimony and not proof." Winston, if skeptics made a claim that you stole the ticket, then they would have the burden of proof to show that you stole or forged the ticket. As for your memory being made by hearing about the movie, that may or may not be true. It would depend on what other evidence existed. The people with you in the theater may or may not be telling the truth. It all depends on how much you paid them. He says, "You see, there is no way it could be proven 100%. Winston, forget about the 100%. Now you are talking about the subject of certainty. Only in religion is absolute certainty claimed. Science never claims absolute certainty." He continues, "Anyone who wants to deny can always find a reason to. The burden of proof may be on the claimant for the scientific and skeptical community to accept it, which is fine and understandable. But this argument is no grounds to use to dismiss claims and explain them away with alternate explanations, which skeptics like Michael Shermer tend to do. That would be more of what a cynic does. After all, why is a debunker's subjective dismissal more credible than one's direct experience? Skeptics can dismiss all they want, but they never seem to understand that they are doing it on purely subjective and speculative grounds." Winston, you're avoiding the point. Skeptics aren't denying. They are demanding proof. That is not the same thing. You try to make the demand for proof appear to be the same thing as denial, for one reason. You don't have the proof. If you did, then there would be no problem in the first place. Second, Winston goes on, this argument does nothing to aid the skeptic's understanding of the paranormal. Winston, without proof, there is nothing to understand. He continues, all it does is maintain the status quo of their own beliefs. If skeptics want some proof for something, they have to go find it themselves. No, Winston, it is not the duty of skeptics or anyone else to go find your evidence for you. He continues, though not all paranormal experiences and encounters can be found by those willing to seek, some of them can at least. But asking a claimant to hand over proof on a silver platter isn't really going to lead anywhere. Winston, it would if they had the evidence. Winston says, that's not how it works. Winston, someday when you are king, the world can work the way you want it to. In the meantime, science will continue to demand proof before belief is granted. Only religion works the way you want it to. So grab your Bible, get down on your knees, and pray to your God. That should keep you out of trouble, at least for a while. Winston goes on, how would one hand over proof of ghosts, UFOs, mystic experiences, or telepathic experiences to a skeptic? Winston, that is done all the time. The proof just never stands up to scrutiny. He says, can one take a piece of a ghost and bring it back? Winston, you couldn't possibly get more ghost-like than neutrinos. They pass through all matter and make contact almost never. Yet humans have proof of their existence. If we can find something as difficult to locate as neutrinos, then proof of your ghosts should be a piece of cake. Winston continues, skeptics who want to investigate ghosts and UFOs should talk extensively to the eyewitnesses and perhaps spend some nights over in a haunted place, rather than just sitting back and thinking up their own explanations for it. Winston, you're way behind the curve. Your suggestions have already been tried. Winston continues, even the well-liked late Carl Sagan, who dismissed alien abductions offhand in his book, The Demon-Haunted World, never bothered to interview any abductees to learn about the abduction experience. That's certainly not the action of someone trying to understand something or looking for the truth. If a skeptic wants proof of metaphysical realities through mystical experiences or out-of-body experiences, they will have to do the work required to experience it themselves. There are a variety of techniques for inducing out-of-body experiences and astral projections. Winston, you're starting to scare me. He goes on. However, most skeptics are unwilling to do these types of things because they consider it a waste of their time since they don't think it's real. Instead, they lazily offer this argument, which makes sense scientifically but progresses them nowhere in their knowledge or exploration. In fact, not bothering to investigate or experience something yourself, but just sitting back lazily and using this argument makes no sense. Winston, when I compare Carl Sagan's legacy to, say, yours, I find it comical that you would call him lazy. If you ever achieve even a fraction of what he did, people might stop laughing at you. Winston goes on, third, the claimant who already has his or her proof doesn't need to prove it to others to validate their experiences. That's right, Winston. You can believe anything you want. It is only when you try to convince others that you might be asked for proof. Winston goes on, near-death experiencers often emphasize this. Their personal proof from their experience or encounter is a blessing, gift, or message meant for them, not for the skeptics. In other words, the claimants, if sincere, have already proved it to themselves. Whether or not skeptics accept the proof is inconsequential to them. Skeptics can believe what they want, but what they think does nothing to change the reality of a paranormal phenomenon. Winston, the reality of the paranormal phenomenon is the issue. Just because believers think it is real does not make it reality. You are confusing imagination with reality. He goes on, the skeptics who only want to see proof from other people without looking for it themselves are totally missing out on their own transcendental experiences. Winston, studying real science is a transcendental experience far greater than any imaginary scenario you can offer. And that's enough of Winston Wu for this week. Now we're going to move on to the science segment. Today's topic, time dilation, specifically the Fitzgerald contraction. Experimental evidence for time dilation, dying muons. The first clear example of time dilation was provided over 50 years ago by an experiment detecting muons. These particles are produced at the outer edge of our atmosphere by incoming cosmic rays hitting the first traces of air. They are unstable particles with a half-life of only 1.5 microseconds. That's 1.5 millionths of a second, which means that if at a given time you have 100 of them, 1.5 microseconds later, you will have about 50. 1.5 microseconds after that, you will have 25, and so on. Every 1.5 microseconds, the number will be cut in half. Anyway, they are constantly being produced many miles up, and there is a constant rain of them towards the surface of the Earth, moving at very close to the speed of light. In 1941, a detector placed near the top of Mount Washington at 6,000 feet above sea level measured about 570 muons per hour coming in. Now, these muons are raining down from above, but dying as they fall. So if we move the detector to a lower altitude, we expect it to detect fewer muons because a fraction of those that came down past the 6,000-foot level will die before they get to a lower altitude detector. Approximating their speed by that of light, they are raining down at 186,300 miles per second, which turns out to be, conveniently, about 1,000 feet per microsecond. Thus, they should reach the 4,500-foot level 1.5 microseconds after passing the 6,000-foot level. So if half of them die off in the 1.5 microseconds, as claimed above, we should only expect to register about 285, which is half the original count at 6,000 feet. Dropping another 1,500 feet to the 3,000-foot level, we expect about 140 per hour, because the 285 has been cut in half again. At 1,500 feet, about 70 per hour. And at ground level, about 35 per hour. To summarize, given the known rate at which these raining down unstable muons decay, and given that 570 per hour hit a detector near the top of Mount Washington, we only expect about 35 per hour to survive down to sea level. In fact, when the detector was brought down to sea level, it detected about 400 per hour. How did that many survive? The reason they didn't decay is that in their time frame of reference, much less time had passed. Their actual speed is about 0.994, that of light, corresponding to a time dilation factor of about 9. So, in the 6-microsecond trip from the top of Mount Washington to sea level, their clocks register only 6/9, or 0.67 microseconds, in this period of time. Therefore, only about 1/4 of them decay. What does this look like from the muon's point of view? How do they manage to get so far in so little time? To them, Mount Washington and the Earth's surface are approaching at 0.994 the speed of light, or about 1,000 feet per microsecond. But in the 0.67 seconds it takes them to get from the top of Mount Washington to sea level, it would seem that to them, sea level could only get 670 feet closer. So how could they travel the whole 6,000 feet from the top of Mount Washington? The answer is the Fitzgerald contraction. To them, Mount Washington is squashed in a vertical direction. That's the direction of motion. The same as the time dilation factor, which for the muons is 9. So to the muons, Mount Washington is only 670 feet high. This is why they can get down so fast. Now the arena goes abroad. This should be a little easier to understand than the science segment. Today we go to India, specifically to New Delhi. And this news story is from August 3rd, 2008. Thousands of panicked pilgrims stampeded Sunday at a remote mountaintop temple in northern India during celebrations to honor a Hindu goddess, sending dozens of people plummeting to their deaths and trampling scores more. People said 145 killed. Rumors of a landslide apparently started the panic at the shrine in the foothills of the Himalayas. Pilgrims already at the Naina Devi temple began running down the narrow path leading from the peak. There they collided with devotees winding their way up. With a concrete wall on one side and a precipice on the other, there was nowhere to escape and they were crushed. At one point, a guardrail broke and dozens of people fell to their deaths. The bodies of the devotees, many dressed in brightly colored holiday clothes, carpeted the path, intertwined with flattened iron railings. Many still held the flowers and food they planned to offer at the temple. Police said they used a cable car at the shrine to ferry some of the bodies down, and helicopters flew in to take the wounded to hospitals. At the hospital in Himachal Pradesh State, rescue workers unloaded bodies wrapped in brown blankets from a truck and laid them in neat rows so they could be identified by relatives. Jawahar Khurana told the news, "I rushed to the spot in search of my three children who had gone to pay obeisance at the hilltop shrine. I failed to understand why God was so cruel to us." All of the bodies were taken to the hospital in the neighboring state of Punjab, where the authorities were carrying out autopsies. He said the death toll was not expected to rise further. Many of the dead were women and children. Another 37 people were injured and in the hospital. Tens of thousands of worshippers had flocked to the remote temple in the foothills of the Himalayas to celebrate Shravan Navratras, a 9-day festival that honors the Hindu goddess Shakti, or Divine Mother. The temple is about 155 miles northeast of New Delhi. Deadly stampedes are a relatively common occurrence at temples in India, where large crowds, sometimes hundreds of thousands of people, congregate in small areas lacking facilities to control such big gatherings. Sunday was the second day of the festival, and authorities sought to reassure other pilgrims. There is no need to panic. Everything is normalized now. And that's the rather sad story from India in today's The Arena Abroad segment. Today's famous quote comes from Carl Sagan, born November 9, 1934, died December 20, 1996, at the young age of only 62 years. He was an American astronomer, astrochemist, and highly successful popularizer of astronomy, astrophysics, and other natural sciences. He pioneered exobiology and promoted the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. He is world famous for writing popular science books and for co-writing and presenting the award-winning 1980 television series Cosmos, A Personal Voyage, which has been seen by more than 600 million people in over 60 countries, making it the most widely watched PBS program in history. A book to accompany the program was also published. He also wrote the novel Contact, the basis for the 1997 film of the same name starring Jodie Foster. During his lifetime, Sagan published more than 600 scientific papers and popular articles, and was author, co-author, or editor of more than 20 books. In his works, he frequently advocated skeptical inquiry, secular humanism, and the scientific method. Carl Sagan quotes. I have a list of them here because he was a very quotable individual. Quote number one, "But I try not to think with my gut. Really, it's okay to reserve judgment until the evidence is in." Another Carl Sagan quote, "Further, fear of death, which in some respects is adaptive in the evolutionary struggle for existence, is maladaptive in warfare. Those cultures that teach an afterlife, or bliss for heroes, or even for those who just did what those in authority told them, might gain a competitive advantage." Now here's a short Carl Sagan quote. Somewhere, something incredible is waiting to be known. Another fairly short quote. The method of science, as stodgy and grumpy as it may seem, is far more important than the findings of science. Now another long Carl Sagan quote. In science, it often happens that scientists say, "You know, that's really a good argument. My position is mistaken." And then they would actually change their minds, and you never hear that old view from them again. They really do it. It doesn't happen as often as it should, because scientists are human, and change is sometimes painful. But it happens every day. I cannot recall the last time something like that happened in politics or religion. Another quote. I told you he was quotable. Science looks skeptically at all claims to knowledge, old and new. It teaches not blind obedience to those in authority, but to vigorous debate. And in many respects, that's the secret of its success. Another Carl Sagan quote. I maintain there is much more wonder in science than in pseudoscience. And in addition, to whatever measure this term has any meaning, science has the additional virtue, and it is not an inconsiderable one, of being true. And the final Carl Sagan quote, those afraid of the universe as it really is, those who pretend to non-existent knowledge and envision a cosmos centered on human beings will prefer the fleeting comforts of superstition. Okay, it looks like Decal is on the phones. So let me unmute you and welcome into the skeptic arena. What's on your mind tonight?
I don't know. I was just calling in because this looked like an interesting call. What was guest one's question? I missed it in the chat room.
Well, he didn't specify. It said, can I call in about what really happened on 9/11? And so I don't know what his question is. And if he gets through, then we can talk about it. But you are free to talk about any subject you want. It doesn't have to relate to anything that's gone on in today's show. It's an open forum for the purpose of developing critical thinking skills, not only for the guests, but for the host as well.
Okay, terrific. As far as the topic of the show, I have a minor in philosophy from the University of Delaware. So I've been trained to think critically, I guess. And as far as what happened on 9/11, I'm not really sure it's the big conspiracy that people make it out to be. Although I feel that the way it was treated afterwards by the media, it was like they used it to justify the invasion of Iraq, which were, you know, they were two totally unrelated issues.
How do you feel about the media in general?
I feel like television is a mind control device, the opiate of the masses, which is why I try not to watch too much television. Now, it's part of the military-industrial complex. The people that own these big television networks are buddies with, you know, these big corporations and, you know, the people that are in control of politics and everything else. So I try not to watch too much television or believe everything I hear.
Let me ask you a question. How do you protect yourself from that kind of brainwashing?
Well, I try to get my news from multiple resources so I can hear both sides of the story, and I try to utilize independent news outlets, you know, news sites on the internet and things of that nature. But I just take whatever I see on television with a grain of salt, basically.
I think your training in philosophy, learning critical thinking skills, is probably the greatest shield that you could possibly have.
Well, I mean, even before I started taking philosophy classes, I think I think I thought a little bit different than the average American. Even before that,
do you find yourself in a kind of a lonely position then?
I wouldn't say lonely.
Do you find many people that are like you?
Not as many as I would like to.
Do you consider yourself a skeptic?
Yeah, definitely.
And do you frequent any skeptic sites?
You know, I'm not really sure how to answer that question.
Let me help you out, because you seem to be someone who has gone through something very similar to what I went through, where I was wondering if I was alone in the world. I thought, how can everyone think so different than I do? And luckily, I was born at a time when the internet has made information available at the touch of a finger to anyone. But the thing is, as you've discovered, TV's lying to you, the internet is full of 90% crap and lies, and you've got to know how to weigh these things. How do you figure out who's telling you the truth?
The thing with the internet, I mean, if you want to find good opinions and I guess analyses of issues in the world, you kind of have to look for it. You know, you're not gonna find it on, you know, the default homepage in Internet Explorer, like on MSN.com or AOL or anything like that. You've got to go out there and look for it on, you know, independent blogs and podcasts and things of that nature.
Let me give you one resource and see if the links on this website direct you to places that you find helpful. And if not, I'd be interested if you emailed me and let me know. But if you go to my website, theskepticarena.com, you'll find a list of links on the side, and they're divided into three groups. One are the site links, like the archives, the main page, and you know, just for my website. The second group is critical thinking websites, logical fallacies, and just things that teach people how to think rationally. The third and much larger section includes science websites, which direct you to all kinds of interesting websites where you can get information on all the different areas of science and, what is equally important, pseudoscience, because you've got to know how to tell the difference. And going back to the logical thinking websites, that was the middle section, you'll find a couple of links there to some skeptical websites that have been, for me, in invaluable sources. And I'd be real interested in just your opinion. You know, if you don't like them, or if you do like them, or if they're helpful. On my website, there's, you know, you can always contact me. And just let me know what you thought of them. Okay, well, why don't we let guest one have a chance here? He's waiting on the phone. Welcome into the Skeptic Arena.
Good evening. How are you?
Fine.
I assume that you got Neo from The Matrix, right?
That's correct. My objective is to bring reason and rationality to the Matrix.
Beautiful. Let's talk about that. Can you give me, like, in a sentence, I mean, do you buy the, obviously the way I just said buy, I show my bias. Do you still believe the official 19 hijackers did 9/11 story? Well, here's what concerns me. If you look up what we were told that a Boeing 767, two of them, crashed into the south and north towers on 9/11. And if you look up the Boeing website and you take off the wings and you take off the landing gear and you take off everything else and just leave the fuselage, you have basically a flying tin can that's 16.5 feet in, I guess, is that diameter? At the same time, if you were to measure the average distance between the two steel-reinforced concrete flooring systems, in both towers, I understand they were about 12.4 feet high. If you take a 16.5-foot aluminum flying beer can and fly it on one side of the building that's only 12.4 feet high, no matter where it impacts, you're always going to hit two of these concrete flooring systems. And when you look at and you rewind the videotape on every single angle that we were shown by the media, it shows that that plane, especially the second hit, came through intact, nose intact on the other side. So how does science explain that? How does one rationally explain, no matter how fast it's flying, that it would literally slice through the building and come out intact on the other side?
I didn't know that any plane made it through the building.
Every single shot that the media showed us shows us for about, I think it's a half a second, the nose came through on the other side, and then that famous helicopter shot where it zoomed in and saw it happening live, supposedly, I don't believe it, that it faded to black as soon as they, I guess, saw that it couldn't have happened that way. I'm sort of getting to the fact that I can't see how possibly there were real planes on 9/11. It seemed like a movie to me. It didn't seem real. A lot of things have happened since 9/11, but that gets into the political thing, so I'll leave it at the science. So go ahead.
Okay, well, DeKalb actually was interested in this 9/11 story.
Okay. First of all, I'd just like to say that I used to live on the Lower East Side of Manhattan in Battery Park City. So when I walked out of my apartment building and like down to the parking garage and looked up into the sky, I could see the gap where the World Trade Center used to be. I walked by Ground Zero on the way to work every day, worked in the financial district. There was a lot of flyers up everywhere where people were getting financial help from the government because of health problems that they had, from breathing in the dust from when it happened. I guess my question for guest one is that I guess you're saying that this wasn't a real airplane that crashed into the tower, or was it orchestrated somehow? What exactly is your claim here? That's all I'm asking.
Oh, I'm not claiming anything. I'm just saying that first of all, the official story that 19 hijackers, commanded over airplanes is ridiculous on the surface, and the fact that the world's greatest, air defense in the world all happened to be on drills that day is highly suspicious to me. But the smoking gun to me is, again, how does a 16.5-foot fuselage, forgetting all the other parts of the airplane, slice through a tower like butter with no crashing? I mean, makes no scientific sense to me at all. And comes out the other side on every single... If you rewind the tape, no matter what angle the media showed us, they show that the nose of the airplane came through the entire side, or on the other side of the tower, a city block long tower that's, again, has concrete, steel reinforced concrete, plus all the support beams that go throughout the building. How does it happen to go through the tower unscathed? It makes no sense at all to me.
I can't really comment on that because I haven't rewinded the video and put it in slow motion and watched anything like that. The only guess I can make to that is that it was moving at such a high speed and velocity that was what allowed it to cut through. That's just speculation. I have no idea how to answer that.
DeKalb, did you ever see the nose come through the other side of the building on any of the shows? I don't remember that.
Not that I recall. But I wasn't there. I didn't see it firsthand. So I actually moved there after it happened. So, again, I don't know.
Well, guest one, I don't know what to tell you either. This is... it seems to me like you have more knowledge than either of us do on this subject.
Oh, I mean, ever since I had my doubts, I've been looking at this for years. And a lot of the, there are a lot of conspiracy sites out there that talk about this. And unfortunately, they call people like me, who look at basic science and say, well, this is impossible, they call us conspiracy theorists. So I was, first of all, I saw your name, Neo, and knew that that was from The Matrix. And the fact that you are, again, I'm still confused, and I'll listen to the beginning part of the show in the archives. you're debunking skeptics, which is, you know, my teacher always said not to use two negatives in a phrase, right?
The Debunking Skeptics, that's the title of the website by Winston Wu. He has 30 arguments where he debunks skeptics. So what I do as a skeptic is I give his argument, and then I give my rebuttal to each of his claims. So
right.
It's the title is Debunking Skeptics, but that's only the title of these particular shows. If you go back to my previous podcasts, or in the future, it won't be about debunking skepticism. It'll be about some other subject. But right now, I'm concentrating on the arguments of Winston Wu.
I see. So you, in general, would probably align yourself with me, where you don't believe everything you hear, right?
I don't consider that accurate, what you just said, because that's what people think a skeptic is, and that's not what a skeptic is. A skeptic is someone who only accepts as true that which has been proven true by some application of the scientific method. So in the case of 9/11, we're getting into areas that are most of them are outside the fields of science. However, the particular issue that you brought up is within the field of science, because this is something that can be tested. However, I don't know the answer to that one.
How about another science thing about 9/11? We were told 5 or 6 different estimated speeds that these planes flew into the building, everywhere from 500 miles an hour to, I think, 569 miles an hour. So here's a science question. Can a Boeing 767-200, that was the series that was used, can a 767 fly about 800 feet above sea level and physically go at least 500 miles an hour? Boeing says that it can't, because it would interrupt the shaker system, and the plane would actually fall apart, it would disintegrate, saying that there were no planes, that it was just literally it was a movie that we saw on television, because that's the easiest way to create and instill panic. Now, I'm not saying people didn't die, and I'm not saying the buildings didn't come down, but I'm saying that the whole idea that planes hit the buildings on 9/11 is beyond ridiculous to me.
What about the people that were on the scene, that were there, you know, that were out in the streets watching this? How would you explain that?
Well, again, that's not science, but if you want to get into it, I can get into it. If you look at all the people who are on TV who said that they saw planes going to the buildings, all but one of them worked for the networks, all worked for the media, the same media that appears to have done the faking. In fact, at the Pentagon, within 450 yards, you can tell I'm very into this, within 450 yards of each other, there were 8 USA Today reporters who happened to be there when it happened.
That's just hard for me to believe, because Manhattan is a very large city, and I mean, from all angles, on the Jersey side, Brooklyn side, Queens side, you're going to have people watching, you know, even if they're not right there, directly below the World Trade Center, they're going to be able to look out onto the skyline and see what's happening. It just seems difficult for me to believe that many people have a direct view of the World Trade Center, and there was nope, and the media says that there was planes there, and there was all these people that could see the city, and nobody would say anything about it.
No, but I know who it is, and I can prove it.
Will you tell us?
Yeah, would you like to know?
Yes.
The person who, it seems, I say seems with 99% accuracy, his name is Peter Hans Kolvenbach. I'll type that out for you. Peter Hans Kolvenbach. He is known as the Black Pope. Jesuit Black Pope, the boss of the White Pope, Mr. Ratzinger. Peter Hans Kolvenbach has a lifetime appointment to the Vatican.
By black, do you mean African American?
No, it's the I don't know where it comes from, but black seems to mean the secret pope.
Oh, okay.
So it's the Pope's boss.
Do you have a motive for why he did it?
Oh, absolutely, sure.
And that is?
How can I say it in a sentence? Control. How about I say it in a word? If you look at who owns the football teams, and I can prove this too, I can post link after link, all the football teams, who owns all the football teams, who owns all the broadcasting companies, who owns this, who owns that, a lot, you know, Jews get scapegoated as being the owners of these places. It's really the Jesuits, the Society of Jesus.
You know, this has been one of the most interesting calls we've ever had here in the arena. And I really hate to end it, but I'm well over time. It was a pleasure to have you on, and you're welcome back anytime.
Thanks a lot, Neil.
Are you ready, Bruce? Start walking.